From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. He starred in The Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Moon Over Parador, and Tequila Sunrise. Now actor Raul Julia plays Oscar Romero in a new film about the Archbishop of El Salvador who was assassinated while saying Mass. On today's Fresh Air, the Puerto Rican-born actor discusses his stage and screen career. Also today, the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love. Oscar Hielo's new novel is about two Cuban-American brothers who meet Desi Arnaz and get to play a mambo on I Love Lucy. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest album by drummer and bandleader Louis Belson. And television critic David Bianculli looks at FM, the new sitcom about a public radio program director. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Colombia's Justice Minister Monica de Greff was in Washington today for talks with American officials on joint cooperation in combating drug trafficking. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the discussions would center on procedures for extraditing Colombian drug lords wanted in the United States. Meanwhile, in Bogota, Colombian President Virgilio Barco put to rest rumors that de Greff had decided to resign because of death threats from drug cartel leaders. Barco also delivered a worldwide address by satellite appealing for international help in the fight against drugs. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev was reportedly telling officials of Lithuanian Communist Party that the Baltic Republic has gone too far in the drive for independence. Also today, the Communist Party Daily Pravda accused ethnic activists in the Southern Republic of Moldavia of trying to take power in a wave of chauvinism and separatism. And a fight over a language law in Moldavia has sparked widespread strikes and demonstrations as Moldavians and other ethnic groups try to influence a legislative vote tomorrow. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Hundreds of thousands of Moldavians demonstrated yesterday to demand approval of a law making Moldavian the Republic's official language. The Communist Party newspaper Pravda today denounced the demonstrators as chauvinists. Pravda said they are disregarding the rights of Russians and other nationalities within the republic. Meanwhile, Soviet television tonight said at least 150 Moldavian enterprises have been shut down in a strike by Russian speakers who are opposed to the language law. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
In Miami, in the last full day of campaigning for tomorrow's special election to fill Claude Pepper's seat in Congress, a committee dedicated to stamping out ethnic politics was itself divided along ethnic lines. Rick Stone reports from Miami.
Democrat candidate Gerald Richmond had earned the unanimous condemnation of the local Fair Campaign Practices Committee with a slogan they thought appealed to anti-Hispanic bias. This is an American seat. But when the Republicans replied this weekend with a Spanish broadside saying, in essence, we're as American as you are, Gerald Richmond, the committee found itself divided along strict ethnic lines. Still, they hoped for a last-minute triumph of reason.
I think we have tonight and tomorrow to raise the level of this campaign and discuss some of the issues that will truly affect our community.
Richmond and Republican candidate Ileana Ross Leighton campaigned in their own neighborhoods today as cautious analysts refused to predict the outcome of tomorrow's special election. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 11 points to close at 2743.36. Advances outnumbered declines, volume 131 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush today gave South Korea 30 more days to reach an agreement on drift net fishing or face a possible ban on fish exports to the United States. The action came on the heels of an agreement reached with Taiwan last week that will allow the United States to monitor its use of drift nets in the North Pacific. Earlier this year, Japan entered into a similar arrangement. American fishermen complained drift nets make unauthorized catches of salmon, dolphins, and other species. While a month of international peace talks on Cambodia move into their final days in Paris, a struggle for power seems to have broken out in the camp of foremost Cambodian resistance leader Prince Norodom Sihanouk. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Paris.
Note to his aides, Prince Sihanouk said he's quitting as president of his own faction because what he called megalomaniac members in Paris had stepped out of line. But sources close to the prince say the real reasons go beyond that. They say he's concerned that his son and commander-in-chief of his army, Prince Ranarit, has moved closer to the Khmer Rouge. They say Sihanouk quit to distance himself from Ranarit, possibly allowing room to strike a deal with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen before the Paris peace talks end this week. Ranarit remains firmly opposed to such a deal, and so far Sihanouk has remained quiet on what, if anything, he really plans. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Paris.
French and Soviet envoys are meeting in the Middle East today to try to find ways to stop the bloodshed in Lebanon, where nearly 800 people have been killed in a five-month-old artillery war between Muslims and Christians. Syrian-backed Muslim groups have threatened retaliation if a French naval task force in the eastern Mediterranean intervenes in Lebanon. France governed Lebanon under a mandate until 1943. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Kiss of the Spider Woman, my guest Raul Julia starred as a political prisoner in a Latin American dictatorship. He played the brains behind the dictator in the comedy Moon Over Parador. In Tequila Sunrise, he was the zesty drug connection, and in Compromising Positions, he investigated the murder of a lecherous dentist. On stage, Julia starred in the Joseph Papp production of the Three Penny Opera and the Broadway musical Nine. He grew up in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and moved to New York in 1964 to study acting. He plays the title role in the new movie Romero. It's based on the life of the Archbishop of El Salvador, who was assassinated in 1980 while saying Mass. Romero used the church to protect and defend the rights of the poor. In this scene, he is confronted by another priest who shares Romero's goals but advocates tactics Romero finds indefensible.
I am a priest who sees Marxists and Christians struggling to liberate the same people. Jesus is part of that struggle. He would not stand by and watch his people being murdered.
So you become like the military and the aristocracy. You wage class warfare. You become violent.
How could we continue to speak against violence when they keep killing the people that we love? And even you admit we have the right to defend ourselves.
You're not defending! You're attacking! And you'll lose God, just as they have.
Raul Julia, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
Did you find that any of your beliefs or political stands were challenged in the process of playing a man of the church and a man of the left?
No. Well, I wouldn't say so much as challenged as enhanced. Because I believe that what Romero's stand and ideology was the correct one. Romero really was not a political ideologist. He was a humanist, and he was just for the betterment of the poor and the oppressed and the people that were being tortured and unjustly put in prison. So my stand, as far as these things are concerned, are really pretty much like Romero's. It's really what works for humanity and not any specific political ideology.
Romero was filmed in Mexico, and I understand that the Mexican military at high levels turned against the movie and tried to get permission to shoot revoked. What did they have against the film, do you know?
Well, apparently, what I heard from our producer was that they had shot El Salvador there too, Oliver Stone's film, and the Salvadoran army saw it, and of course, they didn't like it because it's not very favorable to them. Neither is Romero, as a matter of fact. But you know, the truth is the truth. So they asked the Mexican military to not allow the film there, and that's why. You know, the army is pretty much usually the military of one country and another are usually like sort of like a fraternity, so they influence each other.
So what effect did this have on the making of the movie, and did it have any effect on your ability to perform?
Not at all. We did the movie, we finished it, and it was fine. They didn't do anything to harm us or anything like that. They just stayed away and didn't cooperate. So we had to get uniforms from the United States, and we had to get guns from other places, and we had to build the armored cars ourselves. So it was inconvenient, but they didn't bother us.
Raul Julia is my guest, and he stars in the new movie Romero. He plays the assassinated Archbishop of El Salvador. You know, I want to ask you. I'm mentioning your name as Raul Julia, and I think most people say Raul Julia. Do you care when people mispronounce your name? Does it bother you? Because it happens all the time. I've also heard a lot of people say Raul Julia.
I know it happens a lot, and I'm not going to have a heart attack over it, but it would be nice if it was pronounced the correct way. And if people say Julia, then it's better if they say Julia, because Julia is in Spanish, Julia is in Catalan, and either way is fine.
Okay. Now, I think a great study in contrast is your role as Oscar Romero and your role as McHeath in the Pat production of the Three Penny Opera, which I believe you're also making into a movie now.
Yes.
As McHeath, you know, you're a morally depraved sexual sadist and gangster.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to get the body language right for that? Because there's so much you have to convey through your gestures and posture.
For Mac the Knife?
Yeah.
Well, I got a direction from the director of Three Penny Opera at that time, and it was to walk like a crab, and during rehearsals, and I started walking like that, and then it turned out to be like a catwalk. It evolved into walking like a cat, and that was part of the outward feeling of the character. And then inside, I just worked on the worst, you know, those aspects that are we contain inside of us, that are anger and murder and hate and complete disgust with life and things. You have to bring those things up inside of you.
The only role I've ever heard you sing in was McHeath in Three Penny Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And in a moment, I want to play an excerpt of one of your recordings from the New York Shakespeare production cast album of that.
Oh, my God, you're going to play that. I can't believe it. I haven't heard that in 10 years.
Well, when you took on this role, did you think of yourself as a singer? Had you sung in other roles?
Yeah, I had. I actually had. I'm more an actor than a singer, so I'm always a little nervous when my voice is going to be played. But go ahead.
What the heck, huh?
What the heck?
Okay, this is Raul Julia in the Ballad of Immoral Earnings.
There was a time now very far away when we set up together, I and she. I had the brains and she supplied the breast. I did her right and she supported me. A way of life then, if not quite the best. And when a client came, I'd slide out of our bed and treat him nice and go and have a drink instead. And when he paid up, I'd address him, "Sir, come anytime you feel you fancy her. The time's gone past, but what would I not give to see that whorehouse where we used to live?"
Do you think of yourself as approaching singing as an actor?
Yeah, I think I'm more. My purpose has always been more into acting, although I love singing, and I like to work on my singing as much as I can. I really do. So You know, I as it's like singing is my favorite thing after acting,
mm-hmm.
and I take the opportunity to do it anytime I can.
Now you're making the movie version of Three Penny Opera now, right?
Yeah, we finished it already.
Now you're playing the same role 14 years or so after you played it on Broadway.
13.
Okay. So does this mean that you're going to be playing it any differently?
Oh yes, this film version is completely a different interpretation from the one I did on Broadway. The one on Broadway was Richard Foreman, and this one is Menachem Golan. So there's two very different directors with very different, completely, totally different concepts.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Raul Julia, who has starred in the films Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Moon Over Parador, Tequila Sunrise. He's about to come out in the Three Penny Opera. And he stars as the assassinated Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero, in the new film Romero. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Julia is my guest, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about your film Kiss of the Spider-Woman, which was released in 1985. I want to play a clip from the film first. This is about two cellmates in a Latin American prison. You play a political prisoner who's dedicated himself to a cause and is willing to sacrifice all personal pleasure to achieve the cause. William Hurt co-stars as your cellmate. He's a gay man who's a sensualist and is willing to sacrifice anything for love. This is a scene in which William Hurt offers you part of his avocado.
Have some. It's delicious.
No, thanks.
Sure, you don't like it?
Sure, I like it, but no thanks.
Well, then go ahead and have some. It's a long time till lunch.
Can't afford to get spoiled.
Do you really think that eating this avocado will make you spoiled and weak? Enjoy what life offers you.
What life offers me is the struggle. You're dedicated to that, pleasure becomes secondary.
Does your girlfriend think the same thing?
How do you know I have a girl?
It's the normal thing. Does she avoid pleasure too?
She knows what really counts. That the most important thing is serving a cause that is noble.
What kind of a cause is that? One that doesn't let you eat an avocado?
Molly, now you would never understand.
Well, I understand one thing. I offer you half of my precious avocado and you throw it back in my face.
Don't act like that. You sound just like a...
Like a what? Say it. Say it. Like a woman, you mean. What's wrong with being like a woman?
You were so interested in making this movie, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, that you were willing to do it, I think, was it with no pay or with just no...
No profit?
Pay. No pay.
Okay. Yeah, no, we didn't...
Expenses, but no salary.
Expenses, but no salary, that's right, yeah.
Is that something you would ever do again?
I'll do it if it's a good enough project, yes.
Has everybody been calling you up, knowing that you'd be willing to go that far for a movie you believed in, thinking, well, he'll love my movie, and maybe he'll do it for free?
Oh, I get a lot of... Yeah, I get that, yeah. But, you know, it depends. You know, it's a matter of loving the project, and Bill Hurt did it too. I mean, if it's a good enough project, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Actor Raul Julia is my guest. Now, you grew up in San Juan, where I believe your father owned a restaurant?
Yeah.
What kind of restaurant was it?
My father was the first man to bring pizzas to Puerto Rico.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Were they good? I mean, now that you tasted New York pizza, were they good?
They're the best. They're still the best. It's still there, and the best pizzas in the world are there in Puerto Rico.
So was it a fancy restaurant or a pizzeria with pizza by the slice?
It was sort of like neither fancy nor a pizzeria. It's sort of like middle of the road. It was built up like a cave, like a Spanish gypsy cave. And he had the pizzas there, also chicken in the basket, which he was the first one to bring chicken in the basket too. You know, the chicken with the French fries all around it.
Right.
And it was a big hit, and it still is. And it's still there. The best chicken in the world, too. Really good chicken, good pizzas. And it's called La Cueva del Chicken Inn.
That's great.
And it's when you go to Puerto Rico, you must go.
So you must have been exposed to a lot of different influences when you were growing up.
Oh yeah. We would meet a lot of people that would come from the States or from Europe, and you know, so we were exposed to a lot of. So also the culture in Puerto Rico. My mother, you made sure we would go to the opera and to the ballet and to. I remember seeing Arthur Rubinstein play in Puerto Rico when I was probably 9 years old or something like that. So I was exposed to many things, thank God. Also, I remember doing Shakespeare when I was in high school, reading Shakespeare for the first time in English when I was in high school, and then I took to it. And that's afterwards I decided to be an actor, and I already had some leeway with Shakespeare because I always liked it. They used to have me get up in class all the time and recite it because I did it so well. So,
when you were growing up, did you speak primarily Spanish or English at home?
Oh, Spanish. No, we spoke Spanish. Spanish all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I learned English in school, but at home we always spoke Spanish. Yeah.
Could you have stayed in Puerto Rico and acted?
Yes, I could have stayed in Puerto Rico and acted, but I don't think I would have had the exposure that I've had coming to New York. You know, I could have stayed there and acted, but I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have had the exposure that I have here.
When you came to New York, and this was, what, in the early 60s, mid-60s?
I came to New York in the mid-60s, yeah.
How did you first present yourself to casting directors? And I mean this in the sense of that, so that you wouldn't be just typecast in certain kinds of stereotype Latin roles that Hollywood has become so famous for.
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate to meet people like Joe Papp, who really didn't see me as a stereotype, but saw that I had a feeling for Shakespeare and a love for Shakespeare. And he liked the way I interpreted Shakespeare. He's one of those people that doesn't think that Shakespeare can only be done by Englishmen, including some critics. And so I was very fortunate about that. I just met the right people at the right time.
What were the first movie roles that you were offered?
The first movie role that I was offered was in Stiletto. I come in at a party. I play a prince, I think. I remember I had a white dinner jacket. I come and I say hello. And this is Prince something of the something. And I say goodbye. And that's the end of the role. That was my first role, yeah, in a film called Stiletto.
In the mid-70s, I think it was, you became involved with Est, the Werner Erhard group, and also with his group, The Hunger Project, which is dedicated to stopping world hunger. I was wondering if you're still involved with both groups.
Well, yeah, I participated in both, yeah. I haven't been able to participate so much. It's not the Est training has been retired, and now something evolved out of it called the Forum, and I haven't been able to participate. I've been so busy, you know. Mm-hmm. But whenever I can, I do. And the Hunger Project is something that I participate with constantly, all the time, and it's something that I've been with it since its inception in 1977, and it's something that I'm totally committed to.
Has your work with your earlier work with Est or with the Hunger Project helped you as an actor?
Oh, well, definitely, because these things, you see, as an actor, I am the instrument. I don't have a violin, I don't have a piano, I don't have brushes to paint. You know, I don't have plaster to sculpt. The instrument for an actor is his himself. So anything that deals with the self and the individual is a training into getting to master yourself and know yourself, and not only for life, which can be very helpful for life too, but also as an actor, to work on myself is essential. So anything that I find that is working on yourself and or your emotions, your personality, whatever, I try. And Est was very helpful about that.
Your weight has changed from movie to movie, depending on what the role is. You know, I've seen you, for instance, in Kiss of the Spider Woman, in which you're nearly emaciated, and in Tequila Sunrise, in which you're, you know, much, you have a much fuller figure. Do you have to keep changing weights depending on the role that you're playing?
Well, sometimes I don't have to. Sometimes I'm in the right weight for the role. Sometimes I don't have to change weights at all. But sometimes I like to, just to, because it's part of the role, and part of creating a role is the outward look of the role, the physical look of the character. So sometimes I do change weight.
Do you find yourself changing your accent and your speech patterns depending on the role? For
yes.
instance, speaking differently for Romero than you would for Kiss of the Spider Woman or
yes.
compromising positions, you know?
definitely. Yeah, it might not be a noticeable as much to an audience as it is to me, but each, I find that most characters, with exceptions, speak differently. A lot of just little nuances, little pronunciations here and there that are just for my own, it's my own thing. So that gives me an idea, more of a feeling for the character. Sometimes I change my speech patterns very subtly, but I do change them.
We only have a few seconds left, but could you give us a sense of how you changed your speech to play Oscar Romero?
Oscar Romero was a very straightforward, very honest man, very direct. So his speech is like that. His voice is like that. It's all coming from truth. So I got that from listening to him speak, and then I have to incorporate it within myself and use that from myself, you know. Use, when I speak like that, to use that all the time for Romero.
Well, Raul Julia, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Raul Julia stars in the new film Romero about the slain Salvadoran archbishop. Julia's other films include Tequila Sunrise, Kiss of the Spider Woman, and Moon Over Parador. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with journalist Robert Sam Anson. When he was 24 and Time magazine's youngest correspondent, he went to Indochina to cover the war. While reporting from Cambodia, he was taken prisoner of war and held for a month. Robert Sam Anson's new book is War News. I hope you can join us.
I've heard them praising single-minded spirits whose empty stomachs show they live for knowledge. In rat-infested shacks awash with knowledge. I'm all for culture, but there are some limits. The simple life is fine for those it suits. I don't find for my part that it attracts. There's not a bird from here to Halifax would peck at such an appetizing fruit. What use is freedom in a world like this? One must live well to know what living is. The dashing sort who cut precarious capers and go and risk their necks just for the pleasure, then swagger home and write it up at leisure and flog the story to the Sunday papers. If you could see.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It was a big moment in the lives of the Castillo brothers when they played Desi's cousins in an episode of I Love Lucy. It's part of the story of the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love, a new novel by Cuban-American writer Oscar Huelos. Coming up, we remember the Mambo craze and what the music meant to Cuban-Americans. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews the latest album by Louis Belson, the drummer and bandleader whose career was launched when he won a competition sponsored by Gene Krupa. And television critic David Bianculli looks at FM, the NBC sitcom set in a Washington public radio station. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A plea to the rest of the world for help in Colombia's fight against drug dealers. It came today from Colombian President Virgilio Barco as he spoke to other countries by satellite.
We can never finally destroy the narco traffic while the illegal profits remain so great. Somewhere, some country, if not Colombia, then somewhere else will continue to be terrorized by drug cartels until people stop using these illegal drugs.
President Barco told drug users that those who depend on cocaine have created the largest, most vicious criminal enterprise the world has ever known. The Justice Minister of Colombia is now in Washington for talks on ways to fight drug cartels. Stories that Justice Minister Monica de Grift planned to leave her post because of threats against her life were apparently not correct. Her visit to Washington, though, is under tight security. The military prosecutor in Cuba is asking for 20 years in jail for Interior Minister General José Abrantes and tough sentences for six others charged with him in a drug smuggling scandal. Alan Tomlinson has been following the story from Miami.
In official reports of the closed hearing, the Cuban military prosecutor said General Abrantes had failed to inform President Fidel Castro about the drug-running affair. Evidence had come to light as early as February, he said, that officers in the Interior Ministry were involved. The prosecutor's statement appears calculated to distance Castro from the scandal and to put an end to speculation that everybody at the top must have been in the know. 14 Army and intelligence officers have been convicted of smuggling cocaine to the United States in league with Colombia's Medellin cartel. Four of them were executed. General Abrantes and six others, including the former chiefs of Immigration and Customs, are charged with neglecting their duty by failing to investigate the drug ring and with indulging themselves in other types of corruption. Sentences are expected later this week. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Miami.
Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, who says that he hired and later fired a male prostitute as a personal assistant, is asking the House Ethics Committee to conduct an investigation of the matter. In a letter to Democratic Congressman Julian Dixon, head of the ethics panel, Frank promised to cooperate fully. Angry Yugoslav farmers have demonstrated in front of their country's federal parliament, demanding higher prices for their goods. The farmers are concerned about efforts by the Yugoslav government to control runaway inflation by forcing food prices down. A late buying surge helped Wall Street post a new record closing. The Dow Jones Industrials closed up 11 points in moderate trading to close at 2,743. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz drummer Louis Belson began playing his instrument when he was 3. He won a nationwide drum competition, sponsored by Gene Krupa, when he was 17, and joined Benny Goodman's band before he turned 20. In his prime, Belson played in the big bands of Tommy Dorsey, Harry James, and Duke Ellington, and for many years worked with his wife, singer Pearl Bailey. These days, Belson leads his own big band. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of Belson's latest album.
In the jazz world, you hear a lot about what killed off the big swing bands of the 1940s. Rising costs made it too expensive to keep bands on the road, The wartime draft depleted the ranks of qualified players, and bebop was making the old swing style sound outmoded. Then R&B and rock and roll replaced swing as young people's dance music. These are all good reasons why big bands died off. The only hitch is, not all of them did. Some leaders, like Duke Ellington, kept their bands intact throughout the lean years. Others, like Count Basie, disbanded temporarily but regrouped when they could. Nowadays, there are lots of big bands in Europe, where jazz receives more government funding than it does at home. In the States, mainstream big bands have been kept alive by well-schooled young players and by experienced leaders who apprenticed in classic swing bands. Most conspicuous among the latter group is drummer Louis Belson. His latest album is East Side Swede on the Music Masters label. Belson is a paradox, a tasteful leader in what is too often a tasteless genre. The modern big band is the last refuge of overbearing drummers, blaring brass sections, and screeching high-note trumpeters. Belson's unit can scream like other big bands, but can also handle low-key ballads. That's Don Menza's arrangement of the standard My One and Only Love with Menza on tenor sax. Don Menza is a veteran of several big bands who often writes for this one. At his best, he honors great composers like Ellington and Gil Evans without sounding quite like either. On his tune Paddlin' Madeline, the guest soloist is trumpeter Clark Terry, who played with Belson in the early 50s Ellington band. Clark Terry's guest shots aside, Belson himself is the album's star. All big band drummers push their players. Belson's style is crisp but not overwhelming, which lets his band sound precise and relaxed at the same time. Until a couple of years ago, there were two swing drummers leading traditional big bands, the other being the late Buddy Rich. Rich was notorious for browbeating his young musicians like a drill sergeant. His drumming and his band embodied that same hypertension. Rich's music was nothing if not pumped up. Louis Belson's personality infuses his band too, except that he has a reputation for being an easygoing gentleman. His players sound like they're enjoying themselves. That's how Belson helps renew a genre that refuses to die.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Louis Belson's new recording, East Side Suite, on the Music Masters label. This is Fresh Air. Growing up in the Bronx during the 50s, Oscar Huelos and his family, like most Americans, watched the I Love Lucy show. But it wasn't for Lucy's antics, it was to see Desi Arnaz. Huelos gave Desi Arnaz a central role in his new novel, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. The story is about two brothers in a mambo band who appear on an episode of Lucy as Desi's singing cousins. The book remembers the mambo craze of the 50s and what the music meant to Cuban Americans. Huelos told me that Desi Arnaz was something of a hero in the Huelos home.
My father, who was definitely very Cuban, coming from Oriente province, which was where Arnaz was born, used to love that show. And I didn't think that it was a plastic image, which a lot of people say it is, the image of Arnaz. I think he did a good job. He was slick. He was also very human at the same time. He was funny. He was a very decent musician. And I think he came off as a very humane entertainer. And it's amazing to me that for 5 years, I Love Lucy was the number one show in the United States. And I think it perhaps had some kind of influence on the way, indirectly, that people have regarded Cubans anyway.
Did you ever meet Desi Arnaz?
No, only in my dreams.
And was he in your dreams? Did you fantasize your family being guests on the show?
No, but I had an uncle who used to play with Xavier Cugat back in the 1930s. He played touring around in Europe and in Miami. The man has been gone for 25 years, but as a kid, he had this house in Miami, and in his garage where he had lots of photographs, there was a photograph of him with Xavier Cugat and also one with Desi Arnaz. So though I'd never met him, I sort of feel this spiritual link.
The two main characters in your novel play in a band called the Mambo Kings. Has that always seemed like the ultimate experience to you, to play in a good, stylish band?
Yeah, definitely. when I was younger, I used to play in bands here and there up in the Bronx, but you know, rock and roll, but all kinds of music. I would think that playing in a big time acoustic band from the 30s, 40s, or even the 50s would be an incredible, liberating, and beautiful experience.
When you were younger, were you ever taken to ballrooms that had the kinds of bands playing that you describe in the book, and the kind of dance contests and other contests that were held?
Well, when I was writing the book, I interviewed a lot of the musicians and ballroom hoppers from that era. Mostly when I was a kid, I just went to social clubs and the parties and things, and part of the reason why I wrote the book is, first of all, I love the music, and I love the people who sort of are connected with it. So I know people who are rather old who still act like they're rather young, and they still dress elegantly, and they have that lifestyle, which is they go out dancing. I mean, my mother's 78 years old, and I believe she went dancing last year. So it sort of has to do with, I guess, the vibrancy of that epic. Things have changed. Things have become more superficial, I must say. Everybody's hip. Nobody pays dues. In those days, I think people were more sincere in their lifestyles.
I was wondering if writing this book was, in a way to create a scene that you were too young to experience yourself.
In a word, yes, I think. But it's also meant as a tribute. And I don't think, if you don't write something down, it disappears. The center of the book, which has to do with Desi Arnaz, has much more to do with nostalgia and memory and the way one remembers people who they've loved. I like the idea of using the rerun as a take on memory, but maybe I'm building it up further than to something more than what it is. But I wanted also to do an informal sort of history of the scene.
You mentioned using the rerun as memory. And the rerun is the I Love Lucy program, in which the two brothers, the two members of the Mambo Kings, make a guest appearance. There's a paragraph that relates to that I'd very much like you to read. It's on the opening page.
Uh-huh. Okay. Some months later, I don't know how many, I wasn't 5 years old yet, they began to rehearse for the immortal appearance of my father on this show. For me, my father's gentle rapping on Ricky Ricardo's door has always been a call from the beyond, as in Dracula films or films of The Walking Dead, in which spirits ooze out from behind tombstones and through the cracked windows and rotted floors of gloomy antique halls. Lucille Ball, the lovely red-headed actress and comedian who played Ricky's wife, was house-cleaning when she heard the rapping of my father's knuckles against the door. "I'm coming," in her sing-song voice. Standing in her entrance, two men in white silk suits and butterfly-looking lace bow ties, black instrument cases by their side, and black-brimmed white hats in their hands. My father, Nestor Castillo, thin and broad-shouldered, and Uncle Cesar, thick-set and immense. My uncle, "Mrs. Ricardo, my name is Alfonso, and this is my brother Manny." And her face lights up, and she says, "Oh yes, the fellows from Cuba. Ricky told me all about you." Then just like that, they're sitting on the couch when Ricky Ricardo walks in and says something like, "Manny, Alfonso, gee, it's really swell that you fellas could make it up here from Havana for the show." That's when my father smiled. The first time I saw a rerun of this, I could remember other things about him.
The two brothers in the Mambo Kings, mm-hmm. the two who make the appearance on I Love Lucy, they both came to the States from Cuba before Castro. They came, what, in the 1940s? In your novel?
Yeah, 1949, January.
And they have their band, and they have this guest appearance on the Lucy show, but everything fizzles, and things mm-hmm. things don't turn out like the success that they might have. Was that something that you experienced in your family? Your parents also came to New York from Cuba, I believe, in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Well, by fizzled, what do you mean? I don't see the musician brothers as being failures. I just think that they had their moments. I mean, I think the one of the points of the book is that love is very important. And in terms of my own family, my father and mother did come here in the 40s, and they were not rich people. But on the other hand, they produced a novelist and a painter, and under difficult circumstances. So I don't consider that a fizzling out experience.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's the whole thing. The book is basically about decent people who are artistic, who don't make it big, but in a way make it big. They make it big in other people's hearts. They make it big in other people's memories. They make it big musically. This is... you know, everybody dies sooner or later, and that's a fizzling out, if you want to call it.
The main character in your first novel, when he's 25 and is thinking about his father, says, "Our lives were much different. I'm almost 25. At that age, I've been told my father was running some kind of mail route by burro mm-hmm. in southeastern Cuba. Mm-hmm. Me, I work on East 47th Street in a tall building with a sloping glass front."
Uh-huh.
How autobiographical is that?
I had that feeling, I must say. Yeah, I think I've often asked myself what would my life have been like had I been born 50 years earlier. And I think I would have probably had my father's life, which was to have been born in a farm and then make decisions from there, which is to come to the States or stay there. The thing about Cubans who, of my father's generation, the ironic thing is that if he had stayed in Cuba, he would have left because of the revolution, no doubt. And he was destined to come here, for example.
What brought your parents to the States?
I just think they were fairly ambitious in a way, high-stepping. My father, I think, was an ambitious chap, and I guess he wanted to see something different. And Cubans I've talked to who came here in that period were often talk about just being enamored of the image of the States that they saw from movies, but also it wasn't an impossibility. I mean, people sometimes just went from Cuba to the United States, spent 3 months, went back for years and years and years.
In both of your novels, there's mm-hmm. a character who is devastated by the death of someone close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first novel,
very good.
In the first novel, the mother says after her husband has died, and the son is thinking about the father too. And the mother says, "If you think too much about a dead person, he will think you are calling him."
Mm-hmm.
Is that something your mother ever told you, and would you explain what that means?
Oh, I heard it on some street corner one day. what I think is that, you know, people linger on in memory, and my experience with Cubans is that there's a very strong sense that the dead are not dead, and that it's not impossible to, I wouldn't say summon them, but they're always with you.
Well, thanks a lot for doing the interview.
Okay, well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oscar Huelo's novel, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what's the latest story coming out of Colombia?
Terry, President Barco of Colombia addressed his country and the rest of the world today, speaking in English, about the difficulties of the drug war in his country and how the rest of us, the rest of the family of nations, can help him fight it, mainly by curbing our appetite for cocaine. We'll have a piece on drug interdiction and how we hope to make it work a bit better. That's coming from Florida. And we will remember columnist Joseph Alsop. Joseph Alsop died this morning at the age of 88. He was a columnist, remember, who spoke out so strongly against Senator Joe McCarthy.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the past couple of weeks on Wednesday nights, public radio listeners have been able to tune into a new station on TV. The NBC sitcom FM is set in a fictional public radio station. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
This is WGEO-FM, Radio Free DC.
I'm Ted Costas, and I'll be with you from 9 till noon.
It had to happen someday that some TV producer would make a situation comedy about public radio. Everything sooner or later inspires a TV sitcom. Well, the good news about the current NBC series FM is that its producers are Alan Burns and Dan Wilcox. Wilcox wrote a lot of scripts for MASH, and Burns was one of the creators of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The bad news, though, is that Burns and Wilcox, in the first four episodes, haven't come up with a series that does justice to the concept. The potential is still there, but so far the scripts are headed in the wrong direction. They're stressing private relationships, not public radio. Robert Hayes, star of the original Airplane movie, plays Ted Costas, the program director of WGEO and the host of its morning music show, Long Day's Journey into Lunch. The Costas character is based on Tom Schnabel, the Santa Monica public radio host whose real show on KCRW has a Eugene O'Neill-ish title, Morning Becomes Eclectic. The FM sitcom also has a character based loosely and poorly on KCRW's Harry Shearer. The standout character, though, is a pompous talk show host named Harrison Green. Fred Applegate plays him perfectly, like a baritone Ted Baxter. In this scene, Harrison and Costas attract the attention of a beautiful bartender.
I thought that woman showed a remarkable commitment that you rarely see in satirical comedy.
My God, I know that voice, Harrison Green. Oh, I listen to you every day. This is really a thrill. I love the way your mind works and that voice.
Did you ever listen to Ted Costas on Long Day's Journey into Lunch?
No. Mr. Green, would you say something, anything to hear that voice?
All right. This is not a good martini. The gin is bruised as if you'd shaken it. And is this your idea of no pimento? It's a good thing you have a secure profession like acting to fall back on.
I can't help noting that this is the second time in three shows that a gorgeous woman has thrown herself at a WGEO radio host because she was in love with his voice. Now, granted, I've only been doing TV reviews on Fresh Air for a few years now, but I've yet to encounter my first public radio groupie. Interested parties, however, are encouraged to apply. As for FM, its best hope for rising to the level of WKRP in Cincinnati or the newsroom humor of the Mary Tyler Moore Show is to play down the romantic subplots and play up the public radio setting. There ought to be more politics, national and internal, and more time spent on the air and with the station's producers and engineers. Trust me, enough funny stuff happens to the people at a public radio station that you don't need to make anything up. For example, have you heard the one about the public radio TV critic whose house was destroyed by lightning? Now that's entertainment.
I'm Quentin Lamoureux. Welcome to the Classics Shelf.
They rejected the nomination.
Have you forgotten to send in your pledge?
P.S. The Bianculis weren't home when their house caught fire. They're rebuilding their home while David continues to make bad jokes about the fire. He's also a television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert Sam Anson remembers being a rookie reporter covering the war in Vietnam and Cambodia, dealing with his hawkish editors at Time magazine, and being captured by the Khmer Rouge. Also, bringing the inanimate to life with computer animator John Lasseter. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.